Better Golf Podcast, powered by Wynn Daily Sports, where bettors go to bet better. Here are your hosts, Tee Off Sports and Sticks Picks.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 3 of the Better Golf Podcast for the Players Championship. With me, as always, we got Spencer Aguiar, and exciting, exciting news today. We got a special guest from ESPN, David Bierman. I just asked you how to pronounce your name. David Bierman. He is the deputy editor for sports betting content over at ESPN. David, how's it going today? And thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Big tournament coming up. And if I had a dollar for every person mispronounced my name, I wouldn't have to bet on sports. So we're good.
Spencer, how are we doing?
Doing well. A good tournament last week. I think you had a winning week. I had a winning week. We'll talk about it later, but I'm excited to get going for the Players Championship. Big tournament this week. So, you know, David, thank you for coming on. This is going to be exciting.
Yeah. I mean, outside of the majors, this is my favorite tournament of the year. I know they call it the fifth major for a reason, but just a great course, great atmosphere. I've gotten to go to it a couple of times, and it's just an exciting atmosphere with great holes and a lot of high risk, high reward holes, which makes it a lot of fun. And it's never boring, I can tell you that much.
For those that don't know you, I know I've seen you on TV doing a couple shows before. Do you kind of want to go into your background? You've been in the gambling industry, you know, longer than Spencer and I combined. So I'd love to hear your insight, just everything that you do on a day-to-day basis and what you're doing at ESPN. It'd be great to learn a little bit more about you.
Sure. I spent 14 years at ESPN Stats and Information Department, which basically is the epicenter for all stats content that goes to all the live shows, remote shows, etc. Part of those years were spent as the golf researcher, researching weekly golf events and then traveling to the ones that we had on our air, which was the Masters, US, and British Open. So got to do a lot of travel and a lot of good golf. Also did some college football and some baseball tonight. So I spent 14 years in that department, growing and moving up into management. And the last couple of years while I was in there, I started pushing gambling content long before gambling content became the norm. It was one of those taboo things that tongue in cheek, you didn't hear much about it. And if you did, it was one of those, well, that meant something to somebody at a Brent Musburger or Al Michaels or someone. but we continued to grow in terms of what we had at our disposal back in 2014. We reached out to people in Las Vegas and bought a couple of gambling databases that were able to bring in house and then kind of increase our gambling presence. But yet still, obviously, it was only legal in one state, so there was no reason for the company, ESPN or Disney, to buy in because it wasn't legalized yet. What we got ready for, and then, of course, as you know, in 2018, when PASPA overturned, when the Supreme Court overturned PASPA and became, you know, states were able to legalize sports betting, that's where it started taking off. We did a pilot, which eventually became Daily Wager, and I worked on the TV side to help launch that show from the ground up. And after we got that off the ground and going and supporting it with the compression that you see, the L-shaped compression on the screen that has all the stats information on it, that came straight from that group. When all that was said and done, I moved over to the digital side to oversee ESPN Chalk and work with Daily Wager every single day to produce gambling content for the company. We have partners in Caesars, William Hill, and DraftKings working with the business side to help get those deals together and making sure that whenever our shows, whether it be Daily Wager or Bet, which is on YouTube 3 days a week with Joe Fortenbaugh and Tyler Folsom, obviously Doug Kazarian hosts our Daily Wager show. Whenever they need something, you know, I help them get it from our Caesars William Hill partner. So it's a lot of fun. My job went from basically doing all sports and having gambling as sort of like a side gig to now being like that's my job every single day is sports betting content and growing it at ESPN. So it's a lot of fun and it's exciting, and I'm happy to be able to share that with you guys and to do, you know, a little chat about golf today.
No, that's great. We absolutely appreciate it. Sounds like you're living the dream. That is, I think, all of our dream job is to, yeah, right? Like you get to talk about sports betting all the time. While we're here, what'd you think of the Arnold Palmer Invitational? I know Bryson kind of ran away with it Sunday. In my opinion, he did. I didn't have any faith in Lee Westwood closing that out, but it was really cool to see him play. I just learned that his girlfriend was his caddy. I know, like, I was slowly seeing her over the weekend. I was like, you know, who is that? Eventually Googled it, but that's just a really cool story for Lee. He's been such a good player for so long, so it was really cool to see him the final tee off on Sunday. But how'd it go for you? Any big bets? How was Arnold Palmer for you?
It actually started out great on Thursday. I had a piece of Corey Connors as first round leader, and he went to the ninth hole, which was his 18th hole on Thursday. with a one-shot lead over Rory McIlroy to pay off a 50-1 bet. He wound up bogeying the hole, missing a seven-footer, but I was still able to split that price at 25-1. So got off to a good start there. And in the end, I didn't hit any of the winner. I didn't hit Bryson, but I did hit top 10s on, was it Willie Z and Matt Fitzpatrick, two guys who finished T10. And then I had Tommy Fleetwood as a T20 who also finished T10. I didn't know if Tommy was going to get that high, so I got him as a T20. So it was a successful week in terms of in the green as opposed to the red. Hit three of the five tournament head-to-heads that I had, and then won a DraftKings event as well. So the API was a good one for me. And the thing about golf betting is, at least I have seen it over the years, is you either do really, really well or you swing and miss. You take a philosophy to an event and a certain style and certain metrics, which I'm sure we'll get into, and either you hit or you miss. There's very rarely weeks where it's middle of the road. Oh, yeah, I broke even. You either have a really good week or a really crappy week, and that's just golf betting in a nutshell, where if you read it wrong, you read it wrong. There's not much you can do about it. Last week, I was happy to get a couple of those right and be in the positive. And, I mean, Connors kicked me off on Thursday right off the bat. And I had about 125-1 as well. So I went into Sunday with a live runner there, but he obviously didn't get it done. But, you know, the three guys at the top of the leaderboard, obviously, I don't know Corey Connors at all, but, you know, I liked him because of what he did for me on Thursday. Having worked a lot of the golf in the past, Lee Westwood, great guy, you know, great golfer, want to see him win a major one year. And how can you not root for Bryson DeChambeau when he can crush the ball? You know, he's every hat golfer's dream is to be able to hit the ball over the lake like he does. So it's fun to watch. It's exciting. It's good that golf has someone like Bryson to go out there and shake things up. And I know he's not the most well-liked player because he's changing the game. But Tiger changed the game as well. And that's what these great players do. And that course was set up perfectly for Bryson. He took full advantage of it. And it was fun to watch. And he'll probably contend again this week because if he hit the ball as far as he does and straight, he'll be fine.
Yeah. I think David made a very interesting point there where I know, Nick, you and I are running our models in a certain way where we're trying to build out a tournament. We're trying to build out a concept of what we're doing. When you do that, you're either going to be correct with your assumption of what you're doing with it, or you're going to be incorrect with your assumption. Obviously, the goal is always to try to build it out in a fashion to where your numbers are what ends up being the correct answer with it. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be weeks where you hit and miss. And I think the Players Championship this week is a really good example of that, because we'll get more into this when we start talking about the course, but it's only going to be the second year since 2006 that we've moved it from May to March. I think that's something that we'll have to discuss with if any of us think it changes the way that it plays, if it's going to require a different kind of player, because I do think that the course does change. And you know, I'd be curious to hear what you guys think on that once we get to it. But I think that's an astute point from David, and just something that the general public sometimes misses when they're looking at things. Like, if you're analyzing things correctly or incorrectly, you're going to get more of the polar opposite results with it.
Yeah, I'm 100% with what David said there, and you kind of echoed that as well, Spencer. You either, like, for me personally, I've only been betting golf for maybe like 2 years with a purpose. Before that, I was just shooting at, you know, shooting from the hip, thinking, okay, Rory can win this week. I'm gonna throw $50 on that and just pray it worked out. But now I actually have a system and, you know, grade players myself to see if there's actually an edge I came up with. And like David said there, you're gonna have big weeks. And last week was, I'll get into my good and bad, but last week we talked about on this show how much I love the price of Cameron Tringale for the top 40. And I ended up putting 5 units on it, which usually I don't think anything ever grades more than like 2.5 or 3. But I was getting aggressive and getting a little greedy. So he actually made us sweat that out on Sunday. That was very interesting. We had a top 30 ticket as well. I think he finished tied for 31st. But overall, it was a really good week just because how heavy I was on Tringale. And that was all because of what the numbers said. I'm not necessarily like a Tringale guy by any means, but the model really pushed that out. And it showed that he was mispriced. I think we got him at points bet at like +120. When the rest of the market was like -110, I think I had him priced at -150 for that top 40 price. That was awesome. And then Bo Hogue, remember him, Spencer? I had him, I think it was +320 for a top 40 finish as well. I think I graded him right at 40th. So it wasn't a ton of edge there for me at all. But when I was getting 3-1 on something that I had him, think it was like plus 185, I think was my proper number there. So that was really good. And I think there was one more, but either way, how was your weekend, Spencer? Any, the good, the bad? I didn't have any outright tickets. I don't think either of us had Bryson, but I really wish I would have, but it was just fun to see him absolutely crush the ball on Saturday and Sunday over the
water. Really quick thing on Bryson before we get into how I did with it. You know, we talked about Bryson during our first show at Concession, and we discussed this is what you get out of Bryson. You get the really high-end finishes, and then you get the random, like, missed cuts at the Genesis. And that's just something that I don't want to say it's unquantifiable, because it is quantifiable. Like, statistically, of the players I'm going to mention here, I would say he's more conducive. Like, if you throw him on certain courses, I mean, he's the number one player in the world for me on, like, those really long tests, but there's something that I call, you know, like a clutch equity to it. And there's certain guys like Bryson, Brooks, Reed, Morikawa. These guys, when they get themselves into contention, they're able to give you those upper echelon results. Maybe for, you know, Brooks and Reed and even Morikawa for me to an extent, those guys don't necessarily translate from a statistical perspective, but Bryson has all of it. And the other thing David said that I agree with completely, he's Tiger-esque in so many ways. Like, you have to win golf tournaments, but one of the things that Tiger always gave you in his prime is he gave you the theatrics. You knew that when he made a putt, you were going to get the response from him, the fist pumps, all that. You know, on Sunday, he's going to be wearing his red and black. You're going to have that version of him, and people are tuning in to see what he's going to do. And as outlandish as it is, Bryson is hitting a driver on a Saturday over water. And it's circus. It's pandemonium out there. You have everybody chanting for him to go for it. You know, he pulls off the shot. He raises his arms like he's a boxer who's knocked out his opponent. He's essentially built like an MMA fighter. And you know, if I'm going to make all these like sporting analogies with it, he's essentially golf's version of like Stephen Curry. Stephen Curry transformed basketball. Every kid wanted to shoot 35-foot jump shots. And now you have every kid who wants to go out there and bomb drives the way Bryson does. And we saw it in movies with Happy Gilmore, but he's the real life version of that. And, you know, the PGA Tour needs to figure out a way to market him. And it's, he is the truth in every sense of the word of that.
And Spencer, you hit on Bryson. You told me, you had said a minute ago, sometimes he's in contention, sometimes he misses the cut. And you, at the Concession, you got both. You got the guy who shot 77 one day and 64 the next. And with Bryson, we all know he can hit the ball a country mile. He's shown it. He does it. There's theatrics to it. But I thought the key to me with Bryson was he was able to get his irons close. He made putts like he's never made before, 50-footer, 40-footer, clutch 7-footers to win it at the end. If Bryson is hitting the greens and he's making his putts, he's going to win the events. And even though everybody made a huge deal about the two bombs he hit over the lake, like, look closer, he didn't even eagle the hole. Like, they were birdies, which is the same score that Lee Westwood got from 130 yards behind him, because the drive was great over the water, over the lake, over the fairway, into the rough. You don't want to be in the rough on that course. You don't want to be on the rough in the course this week. And he had trouble getting it out of the rough on both days. Didn't even get it on the green until his third shot, and wound up with, he basically did what Lee Westwood did and whoever played with him the day before. Although they went shorter on in three, Bryson was on in three, just a different route. But it's the key holes like 18, where the stat on the broadcast was 14% of the field was on in regulation, which is just an insanely awful stat, that 14% of the field was on in regulation. And nobody was close. Like, the average distance away from the pin was 45 feet. Bryson's on 18 with a one-shot lead, and he knocks it to within 20, makes the two-putt, wins the event. Those are the things that Bryson needs to do to win a major like he did with the U.S. Open. And you mentioned the other guys with the you know, measuring their clutchness. You mentioned Brooks. You mentioned Bryson. You mentioned Patrick Reed and Colin Morikawa. They all have one thing in common. They're major winners. And to get a major win, you have to have that clutch moment. Colin Morikawa drives it to within 10 feet for eagle at the PGA. You saw what Bryson did at the U.S. Open. Patrick Reed dominates with the flat stick to win a major. And Brooks has obviously won multiple events. When they're on, they're on. But any single one of these guys, you saw Patrick Reed miss the cut last week. You've seen Morikawa miss cuts before. Even Dustin Johnson, all world number one player, can't be stopped. Awful at the concession, didn't play last week. So you have guys that struggle at times because they can't bring it every single week. And you don't know what you're going to get, but you have to trust your process. Sometimes it can be frustrating when you have that off week and nothing goes your way, but you just got to trust what you're doing and go with it.
Yeah. And I think when you like those four guys are really good example of the one thing. I think if you're looking at the opposite end of the spectrum, and I don't want to start throwing people under the bus here, but like if you're looking at the opposite of clutch and you're trying to find like choke equity with somebody, I mean, Tony Finau's a really good example of that. Like there's no statistical metric of a way I can run a model that Patrick Reed is a better golfer than Tony Finau, yet year in and year out, we see Tony Finau does not win golf tournaments. And
right.
It's frustrating. And, you know, maybe it's something he eventually gets himself over with it. And it's not working right now. And I'd rather have that high-end guy if the numbers are grading out correctly than going to the well with Finau, which it was one thing when his price was 50, 60 to one in the market and you could take some flyer shots at certain courses. Not the same thing when you know you're backing him as a 20, 30 to one shot in these events where I don't think he has between a 3-5% implied win probability going into these weeks.
Right, which is why sometimes the strategy with winning money golf betting isn't necessarily picking the winner. As hard as that sounds, like sometimes you can the best way to win money is the matchups, the top 10s, the 20s, the 40s. Only one guy's going to win the event. And to put your money on Tony Finau at 20 or 30 to one when he's only won zero times in the last 5 years, same as you and me, but you can get him in a top five or a top 10. Like that's all I've been doing all season is cashing on Tony Finau fives and tens. Like you take him at 2.5 to 1 or 3 to 1 and you win money on him and you don't have to worry about if he wins. Sure, if he wins, you'll be kicking yourself that you didn't have the 22 to one. Instead, you had the 3 to 1, but the 3 to 1s add up. And the guy has zero wins in 5 years, so why bother?
Yeah, and that's something that – sorry, Nick. That's something that you and I have been talking about, you know, trying to just educate the listener with it. Like if you're betting solely from an outright perspective with it, those markets are so hard to beat. You see the casinos, they're holding 150%+ of the handle on these wagers. Sure, you can find an edge here and there with what you're trying to do, but it's just a harder market. Like – your matchup wagers, your top 20s, that's where you can sustainably build a bankroll. And like, as much as I can try to push it on this show, and I'm happy David came on and reiterated the thought with that. Like you want to be looking elsewhere when you're building these things. I don't have a problem with betting outrights. I think there's a strategy and art to it to an extent, but I'm always going to be underexposed when it comes to it.
I'm 100% the same way. I think once I learned that a couple of years ago, building a bankroll on exactly the markets that David and Spencer just talked about, that's what has, you know, really helped my success in being a profitable golf bettor. But let's get right to it, guys. We got the Players Championship, TPC Sawgrass, a stadium course, about 7,200 yards, 154 golfers, I want to say, maybe 153 now with Will, with Drew. I don't know. Did someone backfill him? Do you know?
I think Hickok might have. Yeah.
Okay, that's who it was. I did see something on Twitter about him, but either way, irrelevant. It's a huge field. This was actually the tournament that COVID canceled last year, so it's, you know, nuts that it's already been a year. Hopefully everything's starting to get better. Golf hasn't been canceled anytime soon. The golfers are staying healthy, so that's great. But the last winner was Rory McIlroy in 2019, Webb Simpson in 2018, Spencer's boy Siwoo Kim in 2017, Jason Day, 2016, and then the late great, I'm just going to say the late great because his golf game seems to be dead, Ricky Fowler, 2015. What are you guys' thoughts on the tournament, David? I'll start with you. You've actually played the course. What do you got for us this week? What do you think is going to be the important stats, and what are you looking for?
This is very similar setup to what you saw at the Arnold Palmer, and a lot of the Florida courses are the same, where you got to be in the fairway, but more importantly, you got to hit the greens. It's obviously easier to hit the greens from the fairway than the rough. But the biggest factor is you don't want to miss the greens. So you miss the greens, you're in a bunker, you're in water, you're in thick rough. Not easy to get up and down. You saw what Hovland did 2 weeks ago at the concession where he made a mess of 18. You saw it a lot on Sunday where multiple players went in the water on the 200-yard par 3 17th hole at Bay Hill. And you got more monstrous holes coming up at the TPC Sawgrass. Now, I know, Spencer, you mentioned earlier about moving it from March to May and back to March. And You asked whether it makes a difference. I absolutely think this course makes a difference if it's in March versus May. One of the reasons why they moved it back, other than the fact that they wanted the schedule to have a major or a big event every month, is the wind is a lot worse in March in Florida. I can tell you from experience, having been there and lived there for the first half of my life, it's a lot tougher to play golf in Florida in March than it is in May. The wind's not as bad. Statistically speaking, this course played significantly easier when it was in May as opposed to back in March, which is why you saw a couple of surprise winners like your boy Siwoo Kim, because it was playing at an easier rate and people can fire at the pins and not worry about the wind. Now, this week, it's not supposed to be windy, so it could play like a May event, but you never know what's going to happen with the March weather down there. But it's one of those courses where tee to green is a huge metric for me. A proximity to the hole, how close you are with the approaches, your areas around the green, and putting not as important here as it is in a lot of the West Coast events that have different type of greens. To me, you really have to get it on the green and give yourself birdie opportunities, and at worst, you're tapping pars. Because where people get in trouble, especially at Sawgrass, the greens are difficult from an undulating point of view. A lot of two-tiered greens. You have to really know where you're going. Not just get it there, but get it on the right side. There are plenty of times, and you look at the obviously better than most putt that Tiger hit 20 years ago that came right after a player before him hit the exact same putt off the green. And there's a lot of those, like 17th green is known for its being an island green. It's also a very difficult green to putt on if you're on the wrong side of it, which Tiger was 20 years ago before hitting that magical putt. So to me, I look for ball strikers, guys who have good iron play that can deal with potentially wind. Because if you look at the layout of the course, water comes into play on 12 of the 18 holes. There's bunkers everywhere. The rough is hard. The greens are elevated. Can you miss off the tee and deal with it? Sure. There are places to miss. Some holes, like the 12th hole, there is nowhere to miss. But if you're in the fairway and you got a shot at the green in, it's a lot easier to go for it. And that's where you're going to score. And guys who can deal with the elements and hit the greens, good ball strikers. You mentioned Webb Simpson won it 2 years ago. He's one of my plays this week at 22-1 and at 225 for a top 10. Not a long hitter, 133rd on tour in terms of driving distance. Not as important on this course as it is on other courses. Driving distance is always going to be important. But here, you can get away with being shorter if you're accurate. He's one of the better iron players, 12th shots gained on approach, 27th tee to green in the big metrics. He's also rested. He didn't play last week, T6 the week before at concession, T4 before that. Guys who win at Sawgrass also play well leading into it. I like everything about Webb Simpson. He was one of the guys I hit last year, and I think he's going to do well here. 4 top 10s in 9 events this year, playing well. Has won at this event before and has the metrics to get it done. So he's a type of guy I like, and there are others we can get to, but a good ball striker who you're not worried about bombing it, you're worried about accuracy.
I love to hear it. That is tee to green. That's the heaviest weight in my mile this week, and then a above average grading for me on off the tee, and then approach shots. So everything you just said about ball striking, that is all I weighed my model on this week. And then, like you said, it's very similar to my weights for the Arnold Palmer Invitational. So it seems like we're describing Corey Connors again. So it seems I'd like some of his pricing, but we'll get into that. Spencer, I'm glad that David and I are on the same page of what should matter and what makes a good golfer good on this course. It's not distance, it's iron play and just being a great ball striker. What do you have for you? Are you weighing anything else that we kind of missed there, or are you on the same boat?
No, I'm more or less on the same page as you guys. I mean, my number one stat is ball striking. I compiled my own little version of a tee to green thing so I'm right there with you guys. The only thing I wonder with it is, do you think, and I heard Rory say this in 2019, do either one of you guys think that because we're going to get, I believe, a softer course, everything's being overseeded with, you have your bent POA mix that they're using. The past iterations of this test, you get these really quick, the fairways run out, the greens are like, if you're in the rough on certain spots, like you have to miss to the right side, you're dead. Like you have to play a run up shot to get your ball to stop. I just wonder if we have a softer test this time around, if players can be, it's still a Pete Dye design. There's always going to be strategy. You can't miss into the water. I just wonder if you're going to be able to find guys that can be a little bit more aggressive off the tee. Maybe, you know, if you have guys with a high apex on their ball flight, they can stop it better. That's the only thing that maybe I might be a little bit different on than you guys with it is I think, you know, we always see these volatile, eclectic leaderboards where there's really not a stat year over year that you get with it. If we just look at the 2019 version, Rory wins the tournament. Rom probably should have won the tournament. Dustin has his best performance. Those are three guys. And Rom's a great total driver of the ball. And I mean, Rory and Dustin are going to hit it a country mile with it. But I know Rory's big thing was you could be more aggressive on the course. So I did weigh a little bit. Like when I go and I compile my ball striking things, I do it a little bit differently than the PGA Tour. I'll go to the specific test of what it's going to be. So I'll take the total driving aspect of it. I weighted it 65% to distance and 35% for accuracy. That's something I've never done at this course before. I'm usually on the accuracy side of the guys that are your Webb Simpsons. And I like Webb Simpson this week. I just think he fits into a different mold of it. Yeah, I mean, that's... do either one of you guys have a thought on that?
I do think you're onto something with the course playing a little softer with the way they're setting it up. There's also not supposed to be that bad of weather, not supposed to be windy. It's supposed to be in the mid 70s, your typical, you know, Northeast Florida weather. And if it does play with benign weather and with the overseeding of the greens and the cutting of the rough, then it might play a little bit easier and give people a chance to go out there, It's obviously, you know, it brings in some guys that have the distance, which is why, you know, it's not the world's worst idea to take one of those guys. And I'm never going to fault anybody for betting a Bryson or a Rahm, a Rory or Dustin. There's a reason why they're, you know, four of the top five favorites in the event. When I'm looking for value, though, you know, you have a guy like Webb Simpson that can hang with them at 22-1 and other guys that I'm going to mention, you know, whether it's Tommy Fleetwood at 35-1. Or other guys that can hit it out there, but also have ball striking. Webb might be a little too short off the tee, but that hasn't stopped him. He's won this event before. He's played well here, and I just like his overall makeup. And I'm a go to the well until well is dry guy, and I've probably taken Webb Simpson more than any other golfer over the last two or three years, just because I love his game and what he can bring to the table.
Yeah, I think. Webb is an interesting example of what you're saying with this, because on my model, there was ways I've changed my model about six times this week, just tweaking little things with it. When I ran my first example of it, before I started thinking that distance might play a slightly larger factor, Webb was the number one player in my model, which is kind of an outlandish thing when you have this field. But I think it goes to your point, David, of what you were saying, that we're looking at a guy who doesn't necessarily get the credit that he deserves. And there's a couple guys like that, like Daniel Berger's another player. Daniel Berger's proven he's a top 10 player in the world at this point, and people don't necessarily equate that with him when they look at prices and they make outright wagers or they're looking at head-to-head bets to be made with it. So I think Webb fits into a different criteria. Like, he's such a good ball striker. His short game is so good. I think he can play his game type and do well. You know, a guy like Abraham Answer is probably a slightly worse version of what he is with that. I don't think Answer can make enough putts to win this tournament. I agree. I think that kind of goes to what we're trying to say. There's many different ways that you can win at this course. And I don't think that you're dead in the water if you are too short off the tee. I don't think that, you know, Bryson, I know we're at the consensus around Bryson is Bryson can't win back to back, and he's not on my outright ticket this week. But, you know, if distance and creativity and some weird different elements come into play, I mean, I think Bryson is somebody that nobody's talking about. And maybe that's more of a DFS play than anything else. But
no one was talking about him last week either, because I know he came off a poor outing at the concession. And, you know, a lot of these guys, if they're on their A game, they're going to win. And it's funny you bring up Daniel Berger. You'll see it in our chalk column tomorrow that's added about 8:30 with myself, Chris the Bear Felica, Anita Marks, and Doug Kazarian are all part of the column. Daniel Berger, every time I look at his odds, it stuns me how here's a guy that all he's done in the last 13 months, going back to COVID, 20 events, 10 top 10s, including two wins. That's all he does. Daniel Berger goes out there and he gets top 10s and wins two wins, eight other top 10s and 20 events. Won a few weeks ago. No course history here. Hasn't played this course very well. But if you're to go back and look at all the events that Daniel Berger has played well over the last 13 months, almost all of them were at courses where he didn't have good course history. And course history is very important to me when I handicap, but to a degree. You can't totally discount someone because they've never played well there, but you have to keep it in the back of your mind when you're doing the modeling, as you say. And although I'm not taking Berger to win because of the lack of course history, you don't really see guys play this course like crap and then go ahead and win it one year. That doesn't mean he couldn't get another top 10. And you're getting 4-1 on your money for a guy that all he does is every other event he cashes a top 10. So he's a guy that you look at and you say, well, he hasn't played well here, but he plays well everywhere. So take a shot on him, probably play him in DFS because he's going to make the cut. He's going to have a good round. I mean, 10 top 10s in 20 events, and you're getting 4-1 to do that exact thing and 35-1 to win the event, 2-1 to finish in the top 20. A lot of guys like him on tour that just are out of sight, out of mind for whatever reason. People aren't taking him, and his odds are longer because of that.
Yeah, and Berger's a guy, when if you look at him, you know, you get – let me bring it up really fast just to spout off these numbers. So, yeah, you have a 67th, a 57th, a 65th, the 9th in 2016 here. He is such a different player than right. He was back in the day. Like, you're correct. Like, even before the tour got stopped, he was putting together performances. He comes back after the COVID break. He's looked like, you know, I mean, we can go into in depth of how far he actually is or how close he is to number one. He's been one of the best players on tour with it. So, you know, course history is something that's always a tricky nugget to try to maneuver around with it. There's guys that are all in on course history. There's guys that don't like course history. But for a guy like Berger, you know, when you look at the types of courses that he usually can find success on, it's the shorter courses. It's usually the par 70s, but a par 72 that's short. You know, this is kind of the right makeup for him. And if I agree, I don't think Berger is going to win this event, but as a top 10 play, I mean, if you can find a number maybe in the top 20, like the guy, all he's doing is doing that every single week. So I'm in agreement with you on that.
One thing I want to ask, I guess, David, Spencer and I have talked about this before, but course history, I think it's all dependent on what type of course we're playing, what venue we're at. So to me, this is in my model, actually, this is the lowest course history grade that I've put on anybody since, what was it here, since Kapalua, which I guess, you know, that's more of it's a strange tournament that's not very comparable to this one. But I'm all over Berger. I think, like you said, he's just a walking top 10. You can probably get great odds on his top 20. I don't think he could win, but that's someone I do want to look at, you know, those other markets and the derivatives of him not winning, but with a top 40 finish or a top 30 ticket, stuff like that. But do you have any other thoughts on just like course history in general? It's you weigh it heavily when you're looking at gambling. But to me personally, it all depends on the course for me. So like Augusta, I weigh it very heavily there. This place, like we talked about earlier, sometimes it's in March, then it's in May. Like, I had a hard time figuring out like how to actually grade this course. So to me, I'm going with form, and then I'm going with the stats that we just talked about earlier with the tee to green approach and all the ball striking.
Yeah, to me, there's three main elements when I handicap the golf, and how you weigh each one is going to determine where you go. And I totally respect where you put this course in terms of course history. And it also depends on the player. The three things I look at are course history, recent form, as you just discussed, and metrics that will match the course. Sometimes they overlap, sometimes they don't. Sometimes a guy who plays the course well has the metrics and it all adds up. And to me, that's Webb Simpson. Sometimes there's a guy who has the metrics like Daniel Berger who hasn't played this course well, but has good recent form. And you got to figure out how to balance the three, and you're going to miss some and you're going to hit some. You are right that it depends on the course. I would absolutely put Augusta way higher than this course in terms of, you know, having the ability to understand the course. I would say not to minimize the course history too much on here because of the way the greens are set up, 17 being a perfect example, 12 is another one, that if you do go back and look at the winners of this event, whether it be Rory, Webb, others over time, a lot of them had played this course decently before. You very rarely do get a guy pop out of nowhere and say, hey, it's the first time I'm playing this course and I'm going to win it. Doesn't really happen here because you got to know where to hit the ball. And the ball striking, we all agree, is important. But with the ball striking comes, where is that ball going to land? And if you know where to put it on this course, it gives you a huge advantage. Not as in, as huge as, like you mentioned, Augusta or other courses that you really got to know where the ball is at all times or you're not going to win it at Augusta. But I do think familiarity with how to play the wind, how to play the greens, and where to miss and where not to miss does help. But that doesn't mean someone can't come out and win. You look at a couple of weeks ago at the Genesis where, you know, Max Homa, like, great win, great event. He hadn't won there before. And look at the guy who should have won it. Sam Burns almost went wire to wire and hadn't played there before. So those things can happen. I don't totally eliminate people who haven't played the course before, but I also will weigh that as a factor to how well you've done before. And some of that outweighs others where you see that I take a guy like Simpson or Fleetwood who has played the course and played it well, but also has good recent form. You mentioned off air, Hideki Matsuyama hasn't been playing well at all, not really contending for the last couple of months, plays the course well, shot a 63, a course record last year before they wiped it out, has T8 and T7, and you go, what do I do with Hideki? He hasn't been playing well. It's not someone I'm going to want to take a lottery ticket on, but you know he's going to play this course well because he always does. How much is his recent bad play going to outweigh him knowing the course? And that's why for Hideki, I'm taking him as a top 20, maybe in matchups with other people who haven't played the course well, but I'm not going to take him to win. So there are factors with all of them.
I think that's a perfect segue into my next question for both of you. So you said you don't want to really pick on anybody that's never played the course despite recent form. And just if I took course history completely out of my model, the number one golfer for me this week is Colin Morikawa. And I have him proper at 17-1 to win the tournament. The best value I could find right now in Illinois was FanDuel at 22-1. I didn't punch the ticket yet because I looked at, you know, the winners and everything like that. It's like, yeah, it's usually not a guy that's going to come out here and do it. Like you said, you got to know the greens a little bit here. And I'm sure Colin could, you know, it's not football where you're going to watch a lot of tape, but he could probably, you know, study the greens and figure out where he needs to be on 17 and stuff like that. But he's such a bad putter. Historically, I know when he won, he actually gained strokes putting, so it's good to see that. But the week before, what'd he lose? 8 strokes putting at the Genesis. So he's just such a wild card there and very volatile. So that's what are you guys' opinions on Colin Morikawa to win the tournament? Because again, with low course history grade, he pops his number one for me, and that scared the hell out of me.
Some guys I throw course history out the window because they're just not old enough to have played it. Like Colin Morikawa has only been on tour 2 years, and this event was canceled last year. And obviously, the two events that he's won. He had never played the course before that. He hadn't played the course at Harding Park when he won the PGA and hadn't played at the other event that he had won because kid's 21, 22 years old. So sometimes you do throw that out the window, and Colin has the iron game to win at this event, as you've seen him win a couple of weeks ago and you've seen him win before. He has the iron game. What worries me, you just hit it on the head, the putting. And he's not the best putter. The week he won a few weeks ago was because of his putting. If he does, but he also gave up the lead that he had because he wasn't putting well. So what you're going to need is him to bring that good flat stick. And I don't know if he's consistent enough on a course where it can become difficult depending on where you're at. I wouldn't rule him out. I'd probably take him in matchups. And I'll probably take him in a top 20. He's not someone I'm playing to win because I think his odds are too short for someone who hasn't played there before. But basically you got to look at course history in a vacuum, you know. You can't throw it out completely because a guy hasn't played it before if he's only 21 or 22 years old, or else you would have never played Tiger Woods anywhere. But at the same time, if you have someone who has poor course history, I avoid that. Like Patrick Reed hasn't played well here. He's not someone, and he's someone I bet on a lot. I love Patrick Reed. I had him when he won the Masters. I had him a couple of weeks ago when he won. He doesn't play well here. He's also didn't play well last week when he missed the cut. Obviously played well a few weeks earlier when he won. But he's a guy who doesn't play the course well, is off a bad start, and there's too many other guys out there that are in better form than to take a risk on someone like Reed.
So with Morikawa, I think you nailed it on the head there with the odds are just a little too short. I think for me personally, I would have loved to, you know, if you were just to say, hey, well, what was Morikawa's odds just off the top of my head, I probably would have guessed like 30-1, and that's what I really would like to see. Like him priced with Tony Finau, I think then I would probably buy that ticket. But yeah, I greatly appreciate your insight there. It was something, you know, just a mole over at 22-1. It's not a whole lot of value for a guy that's never played the course and has, you know, such volatility putting. But Spencer, what's up, man? You were going to say something.
No, I was just going to say that. So one of the ways I'm actually curious to hear, because David, that's exactly how I run my model as far as the stats, the current form, the course history on it. And I guess this would go to Nick too. I think Nick runs it this way also, or at least something similar to that. What weight did you guys attach this week for TPC Sawgrass if we're looking at course history?
Well, I think Nick said it was near the bottom to you. To me, it depended on which guy. And obviously you can make an argument any which way you want. But one name I want to throw out there, and he's one of my longer shots to win. I gave it out earlier today on a couple of other platforms. It'll be in the column tomorrow. Is Adam Scott. Adam Scott owns this course. And Adam Scott is someone who plays very well in Florida year in and year out, plays very well at this particular course. His three wins in Florida are tied for the most on tour since 2004. He hasn't finished higher than T12 since 2016. And if you look at the numbers over the last 15 years, he is the course leader in shots gains total, shot gains approach, and second tee to green. All the metrics we've been talking about, Adam Scott dominates that at this course. So why 55-1? You haven't heard from Adam Scott in the last 13 months. When COVID hit, he went home to Australia and didn't come back until August at the PGA Championship. He didn't come back in May, June, or July. Only has played 11 events since COVID hit. Hasn't done very well with only one top 10. Now, that's where you're looking at course history versus recent form. Recent form isn't great, but you also don't have the data. He's only played 11 events. He hasn't played 20. He hasn't played 25. But with Adam Scott, he is a major winner who really dominates this course. So I lift the course history up a little bit more because you're getting 55-1 on Adam Scott. Whereas others like Patrick Reed, I'll look at and say he hasn't played well there to avoid it. But I wouldn't necessarily avoid everyone entirely because they haven't played well there. I am a big course history guy, but you have to take with a grain of salt because, like you said, this is one of the more unpredictable courses on tour where week in and week out, you can look at the last 10 winners and find some common traits to all of them and pick out one or two metrics that fit all 10 of those guys. You're not going to see that at TPC Sawgrass. Well, like you said earlier, Nick, played in May, played in March, played all over the place, different greens, different setups. The winners have been different as well. You've had guys who have been Rory McIlroy's of the world, Webb Simpson's, and then you've had Siwoo, who was 500-1. Ricky Fowler, awesome, was his breakout party. Ricky Fowler's not a guy I'm going to play this week. So even though Ricky has played well here, Ricky's current form is so bad that I avoid him here. So it all depends on who it is, quite honestly.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting way to describe it because I am pretty in agreement with Nick. I only have it weighted as 10%, but I think that's an interesting way to discuss when we're trying to build a model or trying to build things out. You know, there's so many different ways that numbers can be manipulated. And when you make a small little change, and if you change the course history from, you know, 10% to 20% or 25%, you all of a sudden start getting a different perspective of certain players. Like, you're going to see your Jason Days pop up. You're going to see your Adam Scotts pop up. Tommy Fleetwood is going to come into play. And, you know, for a guy like Morikawa with no course history, because when I'm running it, like, I don't want to look at it and be like, oh, well, Morikawa is the worst player in the field. He has no course history. I have to attach a number to some extent on him. Morikawa is such a freakish talent. I made him the 17th best golfer in course history. I realize he has one round in 2019, which I think he was 4 under par. I mean, I don't know if that's correct, but, you know, I think it's important to go through, run models in different ways, try to get a different perspective of what you're doing, because you'll realize once you start making small little changes, you may not notice that Adam Scott is a play, and then all of a sudden he becomes a play once you run it a certain way.
He is for me now. I completely overlooked him. Sorry to cut you off there, Dave. But yeah, like you said, I think that's maybe something that I'm going to start adapting a little bit, is actually, you know, kind of comprehending the recent form and then course history. Because exactly like you said, we haven't seen a lot of Adam Scott this year. And he is one of the best ball strikers in his games, right? And he's a guy that could putt lights out. So you have that winning upside there was if he's close to the pin, like he could knock down putts there. So I like that a ton. And the one really cool stat that you put in here in your write-up is that his scoring average at Sawgrass is second to Tiger Woods. So if you want to see the pedigree there, Adam Scott certainly checks that box.
Yeah, he's a guy who Spencer talked about earlier, where maybe distance does matter more than taking a Webb Simpson who's short but good striker. Maybe putting does matter more because of the greens. Adam Scott has all of that. He's a great putter. He's a great ball striker, and he has distance. The only thing going against Adam Scott, which is why he's 55-1, is sight unseen. You haven't heard the guy in 13 months. He's played decently on tour. He did have a good finish at the Farmers Insurance a few weeks ago where he finished T10, but you just haven't seen him. He's one of the guys, and I think the world is different with COVID, where a lot of the international players took a break before coming back. Some came back earlier than others, depending on what country you were from. And you can't really hold it against him for staying home for as long as he could with his family. And he just doesn't have the data that would make his number be shorter. So at 55-1, I think you're getting a huge advantage there. And you know what? Maybe he won't win, but he might hit top 20, top 10. And he's a guy that I think when you're watching on Sunday and you see Adam Scott two or three shots back, you're like, oh, crap, why didn't I think of Adam Scott? I haven't thought of Adam Scott in months. I'm looking ahead and thinking, which guy do I want to have on my lineup come Sunday that will be contending? And, you know, the guy has six top tens in you know, at the Florida courses in the last couple of years. Like, he plays Florida well, three wins down there, including one here. And particularly plays, as you mentioned, the money stat, second to Tiger. Like, who doesn't want to be second to Tiger other than Stephen Ames?
I'm with you there. Before we let you go, what other plays you got for us? Who are some people that we should keep an eye on? And like you said, with Adam Scott, that is someone I would have overlooked. And Sunday, you know, if he's charging down the pack to get a win ticket there, I would have been like, okay, how did I forget about Adam Scott? That's 100% right. So you nailed it on the head there. What else you got for us, though?
I'm playing Webb and Adam Scott. I mentioned Tommy Fleetwood earlier, a great Florida player who has basically had one bad round in every tournament he's played this year. So his final standing in every event looks a lot worse than it is, because he's been in contention like he was this past Sunday, entering the final round in the, you know, second or third to last group. And then he throws up a 77 like he's been doing in previous tournaments. Another great tee to green player who plays Florida well. You mentioned Jason Day earlier. I'm going to take some flyer on Jason Day only because you don't really get 45-1 on Jason too often. He's just inconsistent. Jason Day is somewhat in the mode of Bryson, where he'll finish third one week and miss the cut the next week. And that's exactly what he has done in the last couple of events. You know, he contends at Pebble, misses the cut at the Masters, Torrey Pines and Phoenix, contends at Houston. He's just the guy who's too inconsistent right now, but at 45-1 and 5-1 to finish in the top 10, I like it. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Patrick Cantlay, who all this guy does is finish in the top 10s every single week, like Daniel Berger. His price is a little bit too short for me to take to win because he hasn't been winning, but at 225 to finish in the top 10 when he's had nothing worse than a T17 finish since October, I think you're getting good value on a guy who's seventh in tee to green. And of course, I'm going to play Corey Connors because, you know, I'm already with house money on Corey Connors. I'm not going to play him to win, but I think at 6.5-1 to finish in the top 10 at a course very similar to what he did last week, if Corey brings the same game he brought last week, he's going to finish in the top 10.
Just add one thing to the Jason Day thing that David said out just said. You know, we see him historically play well at all the same courses, more or less. Like, he did miss the cut at Torrey Pines here recently, but Pebble Beach, Torrey Pines, TPC Sawgrass. And I think Day's an intriguing person to target because some of my favorite people to target in the market are either your older school guys, and not that Jordan Spieth is old school and he doesn't fall into this now, but these guys that are somewhat forgotten. They were elite talents, and then they reach a point where the market is saying they're 50-1, they're 80-1, they're 100-1. And vice versa, your young talents, like your guys that are 100-1, because I don't think the market is as responsive as on those ends of the spectrum with it. So I think you can get a guy like Jason Day that kind of seeps through the cracks a little bit. All we've seen recently are these ebbs and flows with his game. And we know that at his best, he's a major champion, a former number one player in the world. And, you know, that's kind of what you're looking for when you're trying to find a guy that can find success. He has three top eights here in his last four tries, three straight top 31s on tour. And his game looks like it's trending in the right direction right now.
And you look at guys, Adam Scott, 55-1, Jason Day, 45-1, both major winners, both great ball strikers, both play the Florida course as well. Both have played here well. Both haven't had a lot of success recently. They all fit the same mold. You know they can win. And Nick, you said earlier, Adam Scott's a guy that you would have forgot about. There are some people out there who would forget about Jason Day because he misses the cut 1 week and his numbers drop. And I do like taking guys who play well at a certain course that did poorly the week before, not horrifically poorly like Ricky Fowler style, but a guy who his odds are going to reflect the fact that he didn't contend the week before, because anybody can take the guy who won the week before, the guy who finished second the week before. But can you find the guy that's going to contend? Victor Hovland's a perfect example. No one's going to pick Victor Hovland because he did so bad last weekend. He was also T4 going into Saturday, and he finished runner-up the week before to Morikawa, which arguably he should have won had he not butchered 18. So Hovland's numbers are where they are because of how bad he played. Anybody going to be surprised when Victor Hovland wins this week? No. So there are guys that you can get value on because of how they did the week before or didn't do the week before.
Awesome. I love it, David. Thank you so much for joining us, man. We greatly appreciate your time. Hopefully we could do this again sometime. And
absolutely. Hit them straight. Enjoy the event and make sure you turn in to ESPN Chalk tomorrow. All this content that I've been saying on here will be on there as well in the column, along with our cast of people that will submit more picks than just mine. Or you can follow it at D Behrman ESPN. I'll be tweeting these out as well.
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely. Go give David a follow, guys.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, David. This was great information.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one. Good luck.
Thank you, too.
Awesome. Well, that was David Behrman from ESPN. Spencer, what'd you think? That was awesome. He taught me a lot there. I know I learn every show. That was just a blast. It's really enlightening to hear people that have been doing this for a long time, because, you know, sports betting, you can never be too stubborn or think that you figured it all out, because one, the game is changing. Two, people have been doing it better than we've been, you know, alive. It's always just great to pick someone's brain like that. And David's an extremely sharp guy, so I really enjoyed that. It was great to have him on.
Yeah, I mean, David added so much insightful information. And I think it's one of those things that you just said, like, there's always something, no matter how much you know, there's always something that you can learn from somebody. There's always a way that somebody does, you know, they run their model, they do their work. And it's always interesting to hear somebody else's perspective, because once you get caught in your mold of like, my way is the only way that's correct, nothing else matters, like the game ends up passing you by, things change. There's so many differing things from week to week. So, you know, I was interested to hear how David, I'm not a huge course history guy in most tournaments. I mean, Augusta.
Yeah, neither am I.
Yeah, I mean, Augusta would probably be the one event where I would see myself go a little bit more aggressive. But it was interesting just to hear his perspective on it and how he weighs his model. I mean, like the stats, the recent form, the course history is something I'm always going to do too. And as I said, I mean, I'm only 10% this week, but if you start moving it into a higher percentage, like guys like Day and Scott become guys that make more sense.
Absolutely. No, I could not agree with you more. That's one thing that I'm going to try to do every single week, is just see what nuggets I could take with me and make my model better on a weekly basis. That's the only way that we're going to have an edge, is, you know, making a change before the books do. So let's get into, we'll get into our top 40s, our top 20s, top 10s, and then our outrights, and then we'll get out of here. Maybe a couple of matchups as well. I do not have a big outright card, so that part will go quick. But I'm going to start it off with a gross top 40. Actually, I'll start it off with a sexy one. Again, Cameron Tringali. Free money Tringali is what I'm going to call him. I got him priced at plus 110 to be top 40. I know this is a much bigger field than last week. It's a stacked field. I thought last week was a stacked field as well, but that course just played so strange on Saturday and Sunday. It was really hard to, you know, everybody was up and down. I think Hatton ended up shooting, you know, 77 day one. They shot like 266s, and then he shot 77 again. Like, something was up with that course. It was really tricking the players. But again, I got Tringali right around even money at plus 110 to finish top 40. DraftKings has him at plus 164, FanDuel plus 190. But then you look at PointsBet, plus 260, damn near 100 points higher than DraftKings, and 150 points higher than my number. I'm going right back to the well with Tringali. I'm not going to say it's a five-unit hammer anymore, just because that was probably a little too aggressive last week. But I have him ranked right now 30th overall. So, you know, maybe a two and a half unit play for me, which is still really, really big. But it's just like last week. He's great tee to green, great around the green, great approach shot guy. Like, I'm just going to keep picking on Tringali if the market's not going to react to him, especially points bet. They're just way off with that number.
Yeah, I mean, we probably should just start every single top 40 with Cameron Tringali because I think we're in agreement with him on it. The plus 260 number on points bet is outrageous. And I do think that there is some we should be expecting some sort of negative regression. It has to take place at some point. Like, I don't know if he's this guy that's going to keep churning out top 30 results every week. We're looking at five straight top 31s. But the one thing I do like is if we look at his last two appearances at Sawgrass, he does have a 35th and a 16th on record there. And yep. I have him 15th in my model. I was kind of surprised to see him that high with it. I just think it's a good number at 260, and I will be going it'll probably be, I don't have the exact number yet that I'm going to be putting on it. It's probably going to be a fourth of a unit, probably. Like, most of my top 40 plays range between a fifth of a unit and an eighth of a unit is usually where I'm going with it. I'll probably go somewhere around a fourth of a unit on him just because I do think that it's a volatile course. I'm not going to look to be overly exposed necessarily on any of these things I'm doing. But yeah, I mean, Tringali is just somebody. He's the first name I wrote down again and somebody that I'm going to see myself going back to the window on.
Let's go. All right. I will. I'll lower my unit on that just because I'm probably getting ahead of myself here with it. I'm starting to become a fanboy of this guy. But well, yeah, like you said, it's a very volatile course and he's probably due for some negative regression. I guess that regression is negative, but I'm just going to go back to the well because that's just a bad price, no matter what type of form Tringali is in right now. But here's my gross one that I was mentioning earlier. Nate Lashley. I don't know what my model likes about him besides he's a great approach, but he's just a great ball striker. He's great tee to green, great approach. He's not going to lose your strokes putting or off the tee, and that's something that matters here. David just said it earlier about, you know, you do not want to end up in the rough at this course. It gets you into trouble. So I don't necessarily have Lashley ranked top 40. I think I have him 43rd, but this is just like the Bo Hog ticket last year, or last week. I'm sorry. My price, I got him right around plus 220 for the top 40 market, and FanDuel is a plus 360. So I'm getting, you know, over 3.5 to 1 on Nate Lashley, a guy that should fit this course very well. You know, half of his tournaments out of his last 12, he's finished top 40, but my concern with him is he's never really done anything in a strong field or a top tier tournament. So to say this guy comes in and he can compete in the Players Championship, I would be lying to you. But just if I take away the name and I just put numbers out there, Nate Lashley was popping for me at plus 225 is what I had him at again, but plus 360 on FanDuel. You have any thoughts on Lashley? Is your model hate him? Tell me he does, because I'm nervous. I like this guy too much in all aspects of golf this week, DFS, betting, everything.
You know, anytime your model shows such a big advantage like that, and that's one of the things I was trying to make a point of last week. Like, just because you don't have a guy in the top 40 doesn't mean the guy, like, you know, he's not likely to come in the top 40. That's why you get a plus 300, whatever number it is on it. I don't like him. He's 93rd in my model. Like, if I look at my tee to green on Pete Dye courses, he's 37th. I mean, if I'm looking everywhere else, I mean, I guess he's good. My little,
you don't have to force it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's easy for me to say that. Like, he's not my cup of tea for this tournament. But if you have him just outside the top 40, like, that's a huge edge to have on a guy, to have him that close there. I'm not going to talk you out of it. And I do think when you look at his recent form, you see a 57th at the Genesis, a 5th at Pebble, a 17th at Waste Management, a couple missed cuts before that, a 38th at Mayakoba. I don't know. He's not somebody that's going to make my ticket. But like, as I said, I'm not going to talk you out of it. Like, if your model likes him that much, there has to be some reason why he's popping up.
I'm with it. I think that'll be a really small play for me, similar to what Hoag was last week. But, you know, if you put a quarter to 3/10 of a unit on a guy that's 3-1, you're almost getting back a full unit there. So that's kind of how I look at it. It's not a do or die bet for me at all. If he doesn't make the top 40, my weekend should not matter. He's just, you know, a little extra sprinkle that I like, that I found just some value on. Another one I got for you, Russ Henley. I have him right around plus 115 to be the top 40. FanDuel's got him at even money. DraftKings has him at plus 150, and PointsBet has him at plus 180. So it's like the market's all over. No one really knows what to do with Henley. But when I saw FanDuel have him at even money to make the top 40. I really like my price there on PointsBet at plus 180 because, again, it's an elite approach player. He's good tee to green, you know, Southwest Georgia boy there, or Southeast, I'm sorry. And then, you know, the only bad part of his game, I guess, if you want to say it's bad, is off the tee, but he's a good scrambler and he's a good putter. So I think, you know, it's similar to Bryson. He wasn't that good off the tee last week, but if you can scramble and get yourself back on the green and putt, it, been a, you know, above average putter like Henley is, I think he, you know, it's good value for a guy that usually does sit around the top 40 in almost every tournament he plays.
Yeah, Henley was somebody that I initially wrote down. I ended up crossing him out last minute, and it's not so much because I don't like him. He's third over his last 24 rounds in approach. When I look at his data over a two-year sample size, he's third. The only thing that somewhat worries me is we saw those huge results from him towards the end of last year. And if we look at his more recent form, he has a miscut at Mayakoba, miscut at the American Express. He was in the top 40 at the Waste Management and Genesis. You know, he has three miscuts here in his last four tries. I think there's value there probably at the number. I you know, it's a volatile tournament where you're going to get a bunch of random productions from guys. And I think the approach play of it is probably the more – we want guys that are going to avoid the water. So if Henley's going to be – I mean, hopefully he doesn't drive it into the water, but his second shots and his iron play should be stout for the most part with it. I don't know. He was one that I went back and forth on with it. I don't think he'll ultimately end up making my card, but like as a guy who's 21st on my model, like he should be more in the range of what you're saying. It's just – I don't know, call it a sixth sense, call it something that I just don't like with it. I just got a bad feeling with it. And it was like, well, you know, there's enough other options for me to go to this week rather than take somebody that I'm a little worried about.
Oh, right on. Go with the gut. I trust it. I think you talked me off that one. I may sprinkle a little bit on there again. There's not a whole lot of edge that I found this week for me, but one of the favorite tickets that I think I'm going to punch a pretty strong unit play on here is Scottie Scheffler, top 40. I have him graded at like minus 160, minus 170 in some, you know, do-overs of the model. DraftKings has him at minus 110. So damn near even money for one of my model's favorite players. I'll actually tell you what he graded out to be. Number six in my model. And I am not a Scottie Scheffler guy. I've never really taken him serious. I don't consider him like an elite golfer, but he is playing elite golf. He's kind of volatile, but this is a great course for him. Is there anything I'm missing with him? He's just elite tee to green, great approach player, and he doesn't seem to get in a ton of trouble on, like, you know, maybe one bad round per weekend. So if he makes a cut, I think this guy's going to easily walk into the top 40, and pretty much even money on DraftKings just doesn't make sense to me.
So I'm going to spoil this a little bit and go to a different section with Scottie Scheffler. He's on my outright card this week. I think he's a guy, and he was not somebody that I initially had in the top 40. I think you've talked me into it with your thing with it. I mean, he's somebody for me. He's elite. The only thing that he's missing at this point is a win. He's first in my model in total driving, second in ball striking. I think he's a guy that's able to, you know, fix his mistakes. He's not going to make here and there, he makes some stupid errors and, you know, it might catch up to him. But he is, I believe he's eighth in my model. And I am not somebody that bets Scottie Scheffler like ever. So same. I think I will tell you on that one. Just I wasn't going to go with a bunch of the, you know, plus 100 type plays because of the volatility. But if I have him on the outright ticket, I think I'm going to join you on that one.
All right. I love that. And then one more than honorable mention. So David was talking about him as well. Tony Finau, top 20, plus 140 on PointsBet. I have him not a huge edge there. I think I grade him at minus 115 for the top 20, but plus 140 on PointsBet was the best value for a guy like Tony Finau, who just seems to never be outside the top 20. So I am going to have a Tony Finau win ticket because one day it may happen. I don't know if it's this week, but he fits the course so well. I was surprised that he was even 32-1 on FanDuel. I think it's the best outright odds for him, but I'm just going to do the David method there. Don't not get greedy. He takes him top 10. I'm just going to go with top 20 because I'm a little bit more conservative when I play those markets. But I like Finau at plus 140 top 20.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think you could ever really go wrong. I mean, Finau, like, as I've said during this podcast, he doesn't win tournaments, but at some point, he's going to break the mold and get it done. Like, he's too good of a player not to win. He's 12th in my model statistically. He's 4th in my model when I look at past five rounds and in the last past 10 rounds. I think you said you had him at plus 120 was your proper price?
115, yeah. So same thing, yeah.
My proper price is 120 for him. So, I mean, we're in the same ballpark with it on it. Finau's just a top 20 maker. You know, he produces every single time that he's teed up recently. So, yeah, I like it.
Awesome. All right. The honorable mention. I hate this guy, but you saw that I was kind of sweating a really big DFS day on Sunday with Keegan Bradley. I only played him because you talked him up last show. So great job there. You were all over him. Just a weird Sunday for him, but it was a weird Sunday for a ton of people. But man, he was right there. This course, like we said, it's similar to how the Arnold Palmer played. I have Keegan Bradley at plus 110 for the top 40 market, but it seems like the market in general is very, very down on Keegan Bradley. So I'm not going to punch the ticket unless you talk me into it. But it was just one of those big discrepancies that I had. My number, again, was plus 110 for the top 40. PointsBet has him at plus 250. And the shortest odds I could find for him outside of, you know, my own price was, I think FanDuel had him at plus 188 or DraftKings did. So the market does not like Keegan Bradley, despite being in, you know, relatively really good form outside of Sunday. 2019, he was tied 16th here. 2018, tied 7th. So he likes this course. It's a ball strikers course. He's great tee to green. He's great approach. Solid off the tee. Not going to lose your strokes putting. This one just really baffles me that he's plus 250 on points bet. We punching that ticket or is this a stay away?
He was the name that I considered. I don't have it officially on my card right now. I mean, maybe before this week is done, you can convince me to do this. I have proper at plus 165. That's a big edge from it may not be as big of an edge as you have, but it is still a significant edge. As you said, 16th here in 2019, 7th in 2018. When I look through some of his metrics of what I have, he's 4th over his last 24 rounds with approach. He's 11th if you look at that over 2 years. He's 11th in strokes gained tee to green over his last 24, 19th if you look at that through 2 years. I mean, the one thing that's always going to kill Keegan is his putting. Like, you know, that's something that we're not attaching any weight to. So he's a ball striker who's going to be able to find opportunities. And as long as he's not dunking into the water, like, I can deal with the guy who may not be making putts if he is just avoiding the big number. Cause I think like this course is really volatile this week. It's one of the reasons why for top 40s, top 20s matchups, I'm a little bit more apprehensive of entering the market in a big way in any direction with it. Just cause I think one bad hole can throw anybody off out of the tournament. And Keegan has been the king historically of putting up really good first rounds. And then all of a sudden you look on Friday and he shoots an 82 and he's missed the cut. I mean, that's my one real concern with Keegan. But yeah, I mean, there's a big edge. You know, I've noticed too, PointsBets is always just like, they're very aggressive with the numbers they do. You look at these DraftKings numbers that are more or less accurate, even if I think there's an edge there. And then you go to PointsBet and you just have these massive discrepancies there. So if you have access to that book, I don't mind punching a ticket. It would be something that I would be playing small with it, but you don't need that much unit exposure to try to, I mean, you can win a unit, a half a unit, however you want to play it, by not risking very much.
All right. That's like you said, though, like it is a volatile tournament and I just could not find a ton of edges I like in the top 40. And that's my favorite bet in golf is the top 40 market. But yeah. So give or take 4.5 plays for me there. What do you got? Anybody sticking out for you in these top 20, top 30, top 40 markets?
I'll rapid fire through these right now. So Tringali was one of the ones I had written down. Similar to the Scheffler thing we were talking about. I'm not huge on going to these guys, maybe other than Scheffler and Casey in this situation. Paul Casey, I have as plus 100 on PointsBet. He's minus 110 on FanDuel, minus 162 on DraftKings. That DraftKings price is more of where I have this number. You know, he's playing some of the best golf of his career at this point. He has 5 straight top 12s worldwide. He's gained 7.23 shots per event tee to green over his last 3. It's going to be a volatile event, but Casey's ball striking is elite. And I think if you can get a guy whose ball striking is elite, we should see him produce here. I like him on DraftKings. I like him as a top 40. I think him and Scheffler will be the two guys I take a little bit more of an aggressive approach on. So that would be my second play. Chris Kirk plus 240. Same similar thing as the Tringali thing. I'm just going to keep going down this path with him, however long they're going to offer me this price. Like, you know, Kirk is the guy before some of his off-the-course troubles. He was a top 25 player in the world. And if he gets anywhere close to that, which is what he's showing, I mean, he has four top 16s or better in his last five starts. He has two top 13s here in his last four. It just seems like what he's doing is a little bit more sustainable than Tringali. And I'm going to probably be overly exposed to Kirk in just everywhere. Like, I found a bet on him last week at 240-1 to win this tournament. I don't know if he wins the tournament, but that's a number that I like. That, you know, my proper math for him on that is 80-1. You can still get him at 150 if you try to go a little deeper down the board. I guess I'll just keep firing these off right now. Emiliano Grillo plus 260 at PointsBet. Just another guy that it's a volatile course. He's a volatile player. He's a great Florida golfer, though. And I think that in a tournament like this, and I think on DraftKings, you can look at it in this extent also, or to this extent also, you know, because of the volatility that you're getting, it may not be the worst thing in the world to try to pencil in a guy like Grillo, who's a top 30 machine recently. And, you know, next week at the Honda will probably be, that's the tournament that he has said that he is in love with. I'm curious to see what his price is there. That's a guy I will be playing. Cam Davis plus 240. That's a wager on PointsBet. I don't mind going back down that road with it. Palmer at plus 270. That's another PointsBet. That's a guy who is as volatile as you can get. And I think that he may miss the cut. He burned us when we took him a couple weeks ago. But he's fifth in my model in par five scoring. His issues will always be around the green and in bunkers. But it's an inflated price that you're getting on him. And then if we're just going to get to a couple that are a little bit grosser with this, and maybe it's not as gross as your Lashley one with it as far as the odds go, but Harold Varner at plus 320, I think there's a small edge there if we're looking at ball striking. And Jonathan Vegas plus 400. You know, if this course plays the way that it did in 2019 with it being a little longer, he showed life at Puerto Rico. He was third here the last time he played here. And, you know, I'm probably not going, the one thing we need to consider is that there's 154 players this week. It's more difficult to make the cut. Like these last 2 weeks that we've recommended these plays, we're looking at a 70 something person WGC and 120 something person Arnold Palmer Invitational. It's more difficult to make the cut. We should theoretically have more plays because of that reason, but that'll probably be my card. I don't know how many that was. I just ran through there, like 7, 8, 9 plays maybe. That's going to be where I'm looking from the top 40 market this week.
I was all over Harold Varner. I didn't want to bring him up yet because I didn't know where I stood on him, but he did pop for me. And then Johnny Vegas, I was like, whoa, that is a name I haven't seen in a long time. So I just didn't put the ticket in. But I love that you said that at plus 400. Cam Davis, that's a guy, it seems like every time I play him, it never works out for me. And then when I don't play him, he goes off. So I will take that. And then Chris Kirk, man, props to you on that last week as well. He was a stud and you called that. So I like every single one of those. None that I personally found. A Palmer, I guess he popped in my model, but it's again, I get stubborn. I do not like Ryan Palmer after what he did to us 2 weeks ago. But like you said, he's a great iron player. He's great on par fives. He's very volatile though, like you said. So I'm scared there, but I like every single one of those plays, especially the 4-1 value on Johnny Vegas because he is a really good ball striker as well.
Yeah, and all of those are going to be very small unit wagers for me. Like exactly. The one that I may step out a little bit on is the Casey one, and we'll get into that when we start talking about outright bets. But I mean, that's still only going to be maybe a little bit over a unit there. And then Chris Kirk, we'll see where I get on that number. Like, I mean, 7/10 of a unit would be a big wager for me on that. So I might get there with him. The rest of these are definitely much smaller.
I'm with you. Yeah, I think Casey is just a great price at even money to go top 40. Let's get into a couple matchups. I only had two for the most part, and this was Yeah, really two. I scoured every book that I could, and there was really only two that I found an edge on. On FanDuel, I got Tommy Fleetwood plus 120 over Patrick Reed, and then Scotty Scheffler minus 108 over Daniel Berger minus 118. So the Berger ticket, or the Scheffler over Berger ticket, I got a little scared after hearing you and David talk about Daniel Berger and how solid you guys think he is. He was honestly, we didn't really do a Fade of the Week segment this week because obviously this podcast is a little bit long, so we want to get you out of here, but Berger was going to be a fade for me. You guys kind of talked me into him, but Scheffler, Berger, is that just a stay away for you now? Because it seems like you like both of them. And then what are your thoughts on Fleetwood over at FanDuel plus 120 over Patrick Reed?
What did you say the price was with Berger versus Scheffler?
I got Scheffler minus 108 and Berger is minus 118 on that side. So the juice is on Berger. I got Scheffler as a better play this week. So like by a decent margin, but my model is not high on Daniel Berger this week.
I think you're correct that Scheffler is the right side of it. I'd probably flip those two prices. I mean, there may be a 10-point discrepancy for me on that. Small edge. But I mean, if you're betting every edge, the play makes sense. And I also have, what did you say the Fleetwood and Reed price was?
Fleetwood plus 120.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same thing there. I have Fleetwood more like a minus 118 favorite there too. I mean, it's a pretty much like the role reverse there. So I like Fleetwood this week. You know, the one thing about Fleetwood, when we look at his course history, and this is the only thing that scares me a little bit. And as we've said, not course history guy. He was fifth here in 2019, seventh here in 2018. When we look at what he did 2 years ago, I believe he shot a 78. So, you know, there are some concerns that he could just absolutely implode, but I like that we saw something out of him at the API. Reed is never somebody I'm backing. I don't think Fleetwood can win the tournament, but I think as a matchup bet at a plus number, he's probably a golfer that should be a favorite there.
Awesome. Actually, there was one more, two more maybe, potentially. Okay. Jason Day over Abraham Unser, and then Cam Smith over Joaquin Niemann. They're both minus 110.
I like Niemann. And I mean, maybe I don't like Answer as much as the market does, but yeah, those are like two.
Everybody's on him this week.
Yeah. And like, I mean, for DraftKings purposes, like he's probably safe with it. And that's the one reason for a head to head bet, I'm probably just avoiding it. I like Answer. Like, I don't think he's going to win the tournament. I don't think he can make enough putts to win the tournament, but he is a 12th here 2 years ago. You know, he's trending in the right direction with his game. I mean, those are just two guys to me that are stayaways if I'm looking to fade somebody. I would have both of those two that you're against as, I guess the Niemann one would probably be, I have Niemann very high this week. Answer, I have 27th in my model. Niemann, I have 14th. And that might just be the ball striking with it that's making him such a good play. Like, they're probably stayaways for me. There's just not much there. And if anything, I like the other side.
Hey, that's totally fair. That's why we're here. We don't have to agree on everything. All right, Niemann, I'm going to give him another look under the microscope here to figure out why my model does not like him. I think I have him. What do you say? 14th in years?
Yeah.
Whew,
yeah.
I got him right behind Tringale. So 31st.
Yeah. When I look at like the reason why he's 11th statistically, I put a little bit of weight on the last five results and the last 10 results. That's something I never do. I just think that there's so many guys, like if you take Dustin, you take Rom, you take Justin Thomas, you got such weird results with them, whether it was missing a cut or just a result that didn't quite make as much sense, that I decided to weight it a little bit more through both of the stats there. And then if I look at course history, I gave Joaquin a number for it. I made him the 33rd best golfer at this course. You know, that's obviously something we can't know to be true. I believe he was either one under or one over par when he played this 2 years ago. I mean, that's not the best thing in the world to say with it. But, you know, you're also looking at a guy that he was a kid then. He's still a kid now, but he's 2 years more mature. He's a little bit further along with his game. And I just love his ball striking.
All right. I think that's very fair. And it's a really good point. I need to bump Niemann up a little bit. I think it's a great fit for him. Outright cards. Let's get out of here. I didn't have many. So one for me, I'm going back to the well for Victor Hovland, and David kind of explained exactly why. It seems like, you know, two bad rounds of golf or one and a half bad rounds of golf, people just forget about how good he has been. I think this course sets up perfectly for him. So on DraftKings, I found the best price there at 22-1. I have him at 18-1, so not a huge edge there, but it's just something I'm going to punch Hovland tickets, I think, every week as long as he's over 20-1. And then Scottie Scheffler was my other one. I was looking at Morikawa, but I just didn't like the price. I thought he'd be around 30-1. FanDuel was the best price at 22-1. But Scottie Scheffler, I have him at 29-1, so 30-1 proper for me. DraftKings has him at 50-1. I just think he's way too good of a player and sets up way too well for this course. So that's about it for my outright card. But as you know, I really don't take that many guys to ever win. So it's not my thing to do.
This might be the one week that I've overexposed myself a little bit. And this is something, and funny enough, I also did it at Concession 2 weeks ago. Like, I don't make outright cards that are this extreme in the units that I'm risking on it. So one of the guys I am backing, and I am not going to miss this like I did Bryson, and it's a number that I find to be bettable. And I think the numbers moved, unfortunately, so the information isn't necessarily as good as it would have been a day ago. John Rahm got to 17-1 at DraftKings. I have proper at 15-1 on him, and that's unfortunately where they have it now. Like, you may be able to find a 16 somewhere. There may be some offshore book with a 17. I'm not 100% sure with that. I haven't done any deep diving into that. But I said the same thing at Concession. I'm going to say the same thing here because I think it's something very important to note. John Rahm is the favorite in every head-to-head matchup he has this week. If that doesn't show where Vegas has him compared to the rest. And that's including Dustin Johnson. I mean, it's over every single person. So Rahm at 17-1. You know, I'm kind of going with the mindset this week that guys are going to be able to be more aggressive. I know we get these weird leaderboards. I think we're going to see guys be, as long as you don't drive it into the water, I think they're going to be able to play it out of the rough. I think balls are going to be able to stop on the green. And I think you're going to get an elite player to win this. And that's something at this tournament I never say. And for that reason, I've taken a more aggressive approach. The other guy I've gone with up top is Justin Thomas at 22-1. I know that number has also fallen. I don't love that the whole industry is on him, it seems like. But Thomas is just the guy, and he has a little bit of the Bryson to him. He's extremely volatile. But if we think that the rough is not as penal this week, you know, he has the distance to get his ball out there. And if he's able to play his ball out of the rough and stop it on the green, I don't think that it's as bad for him as it would be if he's like dead on a, you know, whether he's missing left or right with it. I think he's going to be able to stop his ball. I think his approach game comes out and plays. And I mean, him or Morikawa are probably the two best iron players in the world. So that is somebody I backed at 22-1. And just for reference sake, since I mean, we're throwing numbers out there, I put 0.47 units on Rahm to win 8 units. I put 0.36 units on Justin Thomas to win 8 units. I'm usually betting about a unit to win between 8 to 12 on these guys. The third guy to throw into that mix would be Scottie Scheffler at 50. As you said, I have him at 30-1. I put 0.16 units on him to win 8. That gives me an outright card of 0.99 units at risk. Probably a little bit more than I would like. I also have the Kirk ticket I mentioned where I took him at 240-1. That's 0.04 units to win 9.6. I'm fine with him at 150 if you still have that. And then just to throw a couple names out there, the guys that graded as long-term profitable wagers were the ones I mentioned. David mentioned Webb Simpson. That's a guy that I don't know if I can get there on a ticket. I don't have any really exposure left at this point that I can take on in that range, but I'm not going to be shocked if he wins. Cantlay's opening number when it was 29 was bettable. I'm less intrigued at the 22-1 number. Like, that's probably not something I want to go down, even if I didn't have my card already built. And then if we're looking a little bit lower on the list, Casey at 55-1, that's probably somebody that I will just put a little bit more exposure on in the top 40 market. I'll probably play him for somewhere between a unit or a unit and a half there. I think it's just a better way to do it. I mean, Casey doesn't necessarily win tournaments, so I'll get my exposure in that way. Neiman at 66-1. I don't think I will go anywhere with that. That might just be something that I play on DraftKings. And then the one I wanted to talk about with you just really fast before we get out of here, you know, I just consider this to be your boy at this point. I mean, like, my first conversation I remember having with you involved him. What do you think about Louis Oosthuizen?
Ooh, sweet Lou. I don't have any Lou ticket right now because it seems like he's like Vegas loves him this week.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great course for him. Did we ever see like why he withdrew last week? That was one thing that concerns me when I was looking at it. I don't think he's injured. I think he just didn't want to play, but I don't know, or if it was something personal. But I did not get any Louis tickets. He is one of my favorite golfers. I just love watching that dude swing a golf club, and this is a great course for him. But I did not, because I'm a little nervous that there's not a whole lot of news about why he withdrew last week.
I'm more worried about the Justin Rose news. I think anytime you get a withdrawal during the tournament, that makes it worse. You know, Louis's temperamental in this. Rose, yeah, I mean, that Rose thing, we just won't talk about the Rose thing any further. But Louis's temperamental, like, you know, if his bed doesn't arrive correctly, he doesn't want to play. He may just wake up one day and decide he doesn't want to play. I assume it has something to do with his back. That's usually the problem with Louis. I cannot imagine that he burns the industry twice in a row. Like, either he's going to pull out of this tournament before Thursday, or if he tees up, I'd have to imagine he's going to play. You never know with these guys, but I don't necessarily worry about that. And it's not that I have some huge edge on Louis, but, you know, I've talked about this a million times where these European golfers don't necessarily grade out well in my model, and Fleetwood and Louis this week both kind of did. So, I mean, I have 80-1 proper on Louis. I think there's some 90-1s in the market that you can find. I don't know if I will get there necessarily, but I was just interested to hear your thoughts on him, because I know that's the guy that, I mean, you seem to have a better read on him than I do.
Oh, I love Louis. Yeah, I got him ranked 21st overall, right behind Jordan Spieth. So it's high, and I think my proper is at 65-1. So definitely a good value on the ticket. It's just I'm just scared. I don't know what to expect with him. So yeah, he just broke his last week. Yeah, so I think he's good to go, but I probably won't punch that ticket. But if he does win, I'd be very happy for him. But I would be sad that I didn't have a Louis ticket, because I always have a Louis ticket, it seems like.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll get there either. Like, as I said, I'm already so overexposed with it. Like, but I do have room for a 90-1 golfer. Maybe I'll get there. We'll see what ends up happening, I guess, this next day or two.
All right. Well, I greatly appreciate your time as always. And thank you, everybody, for the support. It seems like, you know, every week we're growing our name a little bit more, and we're just here to help you guys out. Hopefully the content has been, you know, spot on for you and make you some money. Last week, certainly it was a great week for my card, just simply off like three plays. I won't be that aggressive on Tringale this week, but you know, that's my boy. So I'm going back to the well. Spencer, thanks again for joining, man. Greatly appreciate your time and effort. And then David, thanks so much for joining. That was awesome. Hopefully we can get some other guests on here as we move along. And yeah, any last thoughts for the tournament? I'm excited to watch the players.
Yeah, just to reiterate what you said, I mean, this, I hope everybody enjoyed listening to this. David was great on this. He added a bunch of insights, and good luck to everybody this week. It's going to be a fun event. It's always one of the more exciting ones. You know, it's your fifth major, essentially. So good luck, and let's try to keep the train rolling this week.
Absolutely. Take care, guys.
All right. Bye, guys.